I am a professor in the political science department here, and it is a real pleasure to welcome you to Boston College this morning. This very exciting and, as far as I know, unprecedented here at BC day-long conference on a closer look at the Turkish model of Islam and democracy is able to take place thanks to the support of truly generous co-sponsors. I'd like to thank in particular the Turkish Cultural Center of Boston, the Islamic Civilization and Societies Program at Boston College, the Boise Center for Religion and American Public Life at BC, the Peace Islands Institute, and the COCALIS Program at Harvard University. I'd like to give special acknowledgement to everyone who helped bring this day together organizationally and conceptually, including Eric Owens and Brenna Strauss of the Boise Center, Kathleen Bailey of the Islamic Civilizations and Societies Program, Elaine Papoulias of COCALIS, as well as Birol Öztürk and his team at TCC and PII. Thank you all really very, very much for helping make this happen. So we're extremely lucky to have a distinguished lineup of scholars for today's conference, and our conversations are going to be informed by the perspectives really of multiple disciplines in the social sciences especially, but as you can see in the program, we'll be examining in turn three aspects of the relationship between Islam and democracy in Turkey. We will begin with a panel on Islam and politics, followed by a panel discussion on Turks abroad, and finally this afternoon, a panel on Turkey and the Arab Spring. At lunchtime, there will be a keynote speech on contemporary Islamic renewal and reform. So I'd just like to briefly frame the topic of our first panel on Islam and politics. Since we have two of really the top experts in the field, I won't try to give an overview except to maybe give a little bit of political context and why this is such an interesting topic to be discussing this week. We're approaching the second year of the third term of AK Party dominance in Turkey, so going on nearly a decade in power. And so it seems like an appropriate moment to ask what their dominance has meant. What has the role of the Party of Justice and Development been for the balance of religion and politics in Turkey? Now, the government's objective legislative achievements have, on the one hand, really inspired hope, I think, in a lot of people that Turkey's democratization will be completed. And we've witnessed in particular how the government has introduced liberalizations in the religious sphere, including increasing religious liberties. And for many, this is really seen, I think, as an appropriate return of the pendulum to a less repressive atmosphere than under single-party rule or military rule and its aftermath. On the other hand, others see in the return of religion a more sinister development, and there are those who remain concerned about the religious influence on the public sphere and who wonder about the fate of this specifically Turkish model of Islam and politics that was honed in stops and starts over the course of the 20th century. So at the beginning of this government's time in power, I think critics were really looking for any signs that it would be trying to Islamicize society, and they pointed to local restrictions or hesitations to post provocative advertising or to grant liquor licenses and the like. There were reports of women who were overtly secular feeling less comfortable in a Turkey governed by the AK Party. Others have said, well, what does this really amount to? What are the large projects of reform that this government has actually imposed or tried to impose? And they point, for example, to this week's education reform project, which was debated in Parliament, as you know, and which would, of course, reform the educational system, including strengthening the role played by religious schools like the one that the Prime Minister attended. So given this trend of liberalization of individual religious rights on the one hand, and this other move to bring religion more and to anchor it really more comfortably in the public sphere, it's fair to ask what will become of this traditional role played by the state in the religious sphere, and what are the long-term implications for Islam's status in Turkey. Now, this is clearly a topic about which many people inside and outside of Turkey have very passionate beliefs. Some of that passion actually spilled over into the House of Parliament this week during the debate about the educational reform. But I'm very grateful that we have here to give us perspective on the broader context and meaning of these developments, two speakers who are really among the foremost experts on Islam and democracy in Turkey and in other Western democracies as well. To the far left, Professor Berna Turam is Associate Professor of Sociology and International Affairs at Northeastern University. She is the author of Between Islam and the State, The Politics of Engagement. She received her PhD and Master's from McGill University and her BA from Bosphorus University. Professor Amit Kuru is Associate Professor of Political Science at San Diego State University. He is the co-editor of the volume Democracy, Islam, and Secularism in Turkey, and the author of Secularism and State Policies Towards Religion, the United States, France, and Turkey. Professor Kuru received his PhD and master's from the University of Washington and Bachelor's of Science from Bill Kent University, Ankara. So thank you both for being here. I'm really grateful. And Professor Turam, I turn first to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for organizing this very exciting conference, and thank you very much for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here. Can you hear me all right? In the face of the Arab Spring, the Turkish case is increasingly contested within and beyond the borders of Turkey, the country itself. On the one hand, it has often been idealized as a model of a secular democracy for the rest of the Muslim world. The integration of a very strong Islamist movement into the secular state and the free market economy has created the strong image of a more democratic Turkey. On the other hand, however, we hear increasingly more about Turkey as a divided country, divided over issues of minority, women's, and human rights, as well as issues of freedom violations, particularly individual freedoms and freedom of expression. It's ironic that a country shifts so rapidly between a model of democracy, secular democracy, and a torn country divided by all of these issues. So instead of juxtaposing these two images, these two problematic images against each other, my work highlights the continuity between them. Today I have three main objectives. First, I'm going to discuss two main trends in Turkish politics, which I call the politics of engagement and the politics of contestation between Muslims, pious Muslims, and the secular state, which I argue are the two inseparable parts of the same political transition. And then I will situate current freedom violations into this larger political context in Turkey. So before I begin my discussion, let me clarify one issue. Each time I discuss politics and Islam in Turkey, I'm asked specifically if I'm talking about the Gulen movement, the largest and most internationally influential movement, or the JDP. And this question is not an innocent one. I'm being asked, actually critically, because I happen to analyze both of these groups in the same book, my first book. And there's a particular reason why they can and why they cannot be analyzed in the same study. The reason that I analyze both of these groups together in Between Islam and the State is because I wasn't interested in a particular group. I was interested in a form of politics, the politics of engagement that I will discuss today. And at that time, during the first term of the JDP, AKP's government, both groups were actually displaying the similar politics of engagement. They were merging in their pattern of politics and engagement with the state. But I highlighted that there were no overlapping memberships, with a few exceptions. There is one more reason why we could actually analyze these two groups together, which I will do today in a couple of minutes, and that's their historically specific location towards the secular state. And I'm going to talk about that, but both of these groups are nationalist groups, and their relationship, their bondage with the secular republic is historically specific and cannot be easily compared to many other Islamist groups in other countries. In my previous work, first book, Between Islam and the State, I followed the largest Gulen movement, the largest Islamic movement in Turkey, from Turkey to Kazakhstan and to the United States. And my goal was to explore the patterns of interaction and negotiation between ordinary Muslims, not the state elite, but the ordinary Muslims with the secular state in and beyond the Turkish state. So in 1990s, these interactions that I'm going to depict in a minute were unusual. They were surprising because the Secular Republic of Turkey, founded by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, has always had an antagonistic relationship with Islam and Islamists. Previous scholarship on Islam throughout the 1990s has juxtaposed Islamists against secular states and against the West. Similarly, in Turkish studies, two prophecies were competing at that time. Either the Turkish state was expected to destroy this Islamist movement, or the Islamists were expected to overthrow the Turkish state. And my work differed from these two zero-sum games. My ethnography provided a different picture. I argued that state-Islam interaction was moving from confrontation to engagement. I noticed this shift in the least expected sites of everyday life, such as high school dormitories and university campuses and tea houses, chayhane, instead of in the parliament at that time. So in contrast to the predominant emphasis on confrontation, I found the Turkish Islamists, this is still 1990s, non-resistant and non-confrontational. But most importantly, they were developing national sentiments, nationalistic sentiments. When scholarly attention was still on the strategic anti-state Islamic mobilization, I was taken by their elective affinities, effective ties, their developing national belonging to the secular republic. So what do I mean by the politics of engagement? I use engagement as an umbrella term to refer to contestation in the area of education, negotiation of the boundaries between religion and politics, hence the terms of secularism, and cooperation and alliance in ethnic and gender politics. And this is all between Muslim actors, ordinary Muslim people, and the secular state. To make this concrete, let me share an anecdote from my fieldwork in Almaty, Kazakhstan, where the Gulen movement has concentrated its activities in schools. In one of the associations of the Gulen movement, I was noticing a group of gentlemen who were visiting every day, and their visits were turning this place into a coffee house or a cultural center where they drank Turkish coffee and tea, they laughed and talked about politics and joked and discussed their family life. And to my surprise, after a couple of weeks, I found out that these gentlemen were not Turkish Islamists. They were the teachers of the Turkish state who were appointed to Kazakhstan to teach Kazakh kids Turkish culture, language, and history. So I realized that the Gulen movement and the secular Turkish state were not only collaborating outside the Turkish borders, but they were also sharing similar international agendas. Well, in this case, it happens to be Turkishizing Central Asia. So I argued that these international collaborations empower the pious Muslims of Turkey and help them integrate into international economic networks and markets. I would like to say a couple of words about the unintentionality of this politics of engagement, which is different from strategic mobilization, strategic decision-making, which are predominant perspectives in studies of Islam and politics, particularly in political science. The Turkish case challenges previous scholarship on Islam and democracy, which either applauded Islam and its compatibility with democracy by highlighting its presumed qualities like egalitarianism, justice, and liberal attitudes, or the same literature pit Islam and Islamists against democracy by arguing that it was an enemy of civil society, democracy, secular nation state, nationalism, etc. So this was a very polarized literature. And parting with both of these polarized camps, I argue that the engagement between Islam and the state was an unintended aspect of the well-organized Islamic activities. Accordingly, the politics of engagement has facilitated democratization accidentally by transforming both the Muslim actors and the secular state. Democratization has been underway in Turkey because of the historical specificities of state-Islam interaction and the national loyalties of the Islamic Muslim actors, and not because of their liberal and democratic practices and goals. In this regard, the gender politics in the Gulen movement is very telling. My ethnography revealed that Islamic male elite and the secular male elite in Turkey have bonded over their similar gender politics unintendedly. There is nothing strategic, there is nothing tactical about it. Nobody sits down and conspires against women about how to exclude them. This is unintended. And why is it unintended? Because both of these groups, Islamist and secular male elite, resembled and adopted the gender politics of their founding father, Atatürk, by inserting women into the public sphere, including them in the public sites, and making them visible in the public sites, while also denying them power in decision making. So basically, my research revealed that women were excluded from the politics of engagement. Hence, I argued that engagements are not necessarily the result of deliberate democratic concerns and actions, but often the effects of shared illiberal goals between Muslim actors and the secular state. Concretely, both the Islamist and secularist male elite collaborated in banning the headscarf by compromising women's agency. This conclusion also suggests that the research on Islam and democratization must take alternative linkages seriously. What do I mean by alternative linkages? Most of the research conducted on democratization looks specifically at narrowly defined electoral politics, comparative party politics, or political institutions. Notwithstanding the importance of these issues, I suggest that alternative linkages between everyday the everyday interaction between ordinary Muslim actors, civil society, and the state, in other words, how they interact and negotiate in everyday life, should be taken very seriously. With this goal in mind, my current project follows urban every sites of contestation, which complement my previous work on cooperation and engagement. So why am I interested all of a sudden in the urban sites of contestation? Well, it's probably because most of my colleagues started teasing me by telling me, now that the Islamists are really engaged, you have to start thinking about how to disengage them from power. Similar to my other ethnographies, the main paradox came from my field sites in Turkey. Just as I was becoming a little too comfortable with the politics of engagement, the secularists have begun attacking the pious Muslims both at the state level and on the streets. In the end of April 2007, the pro-Islamic JDP, AKP government, has nominated Abdullah Gül from its own party to become the first pious president of the secular Turkish Republic. This was immediately followed by the government's warning, Muhtıra, and massive, large-scale street protests in the largest cities of Turkey. Since then, urban contestations and divides have continued to deepen. The current situation in Turkey is indeed alarming. Recently, the arrests and unsubstantiated detentions of journalists academics and university students have peaked. The jails are full of these people who are allegedly accused of some sort of terrorist activity or conspiring against the state. There are 1,000 cases brought to the European Court of Human Rights. In a response to this crisis, call it crisis of freedoms, two scholarly perspectives appeared. One camp, which I call the discontents of Islam, accused the pious Muslims, the Islamists, for this crisis by arguing that Islamists cannot be tamed by the rules of institutional democracy. They've been in power for a decade, and this is the result. The other camp, whom I call the apologetics of Islam, accused the secularist followers of the founding father Kemal Atatürk, by arguing that the secularists founded the system, it's flawed, it cannot accommodate the pious majority or any other minorities. I argue that both of these perspectives are the result of political partisanship, and they're not scholarly analytical enough. So I beg to differ. My current book, Democracy Without Freedom? Reveals a different picture. My ethnography suggests that urban sites that I study, neighborhoods, university campuses, and Islamic art scenes, which seem to be deeply divided over Muslim politics, do in fact produce resourceful contestation and negotiation over freedom and civil rights. Although Turkish citizens are no longer afraid of a top-down Islamist Sharia revolution, they are increasingly fearful of a bottom-up Islamization process. Now that pious Muslims are entirely integrated into the city landscape and share the markets and malls and neighborhoods with the secular citizens, and they share bourgeois lifestyles, the secularists feel defensive of their sphere of privacy and freedom. The nationwide debates that Jonathan mentioned, the nationwide debate on neighborhood pressure, we in Turkish we refer it as mahalle baskısı, are symptomatic of these rising fears which lead people to contest, claim, occupy, and even sometimes get obsessed about certain urban sites. Probably Istanbul, the city which has hosted empires, has never been so difficult to share before. This is because ordinary people feel insufficiently protected by law and their state of their ways of life. The recent turn in world politics, particularly the Arab Spring and Occupy movement across the world, have provided substantial support to the locus and focus of my recent work. That is the increasing centrality of urban space in the context of people's decreasing trust to and increasing demands from their state. Turkish studies suffer from a persistent and misleading perception of both the Turkish secular state and its religious society. So in sharp disagreement with those two groups that I just described, the apologetics of Islam and the discontents of Islam, I argue that the axis of conflict in Turkey has shifted from Islam versus secularism. More specifically, Turkey is no longer contesting Islam versus secular democracy, which European countries are increasingly struggling for. Now that Turkey is done with the inclusion of pious Muslims, it has moved to another level of struggle. It's contestation in the aftermath of inclusion. This is not worrisome, because most of the European countries are really challenged by and fail in coping in Muslim accommodation. Hence, contrary to the predominant view that sees urban contestation as a threat to democracy, my findings suggest that this is a test for democracy. It's a good thing. Divided urban sites push efficiently for liberal and liberal democracy and a liberal civil society that can secure liberties. Now, this is all abstract. Let me give you an example from my current fieldwork, which I've been conducting since 2007. One of my field sites is a highly divided university campus in Istanbul, which is the most liberal campus and academically the most competitive campus. The faculty and students split deeply over Muslim politics and issues relating to Muslim politics, including but not limited to headscarf controversy. However, the campus unites indiscriminately when it comes to issues of freedom violations, academic freedom violations, government's crackdown on the Kurdish people, or unsubstantiated detentions. And most importantly, these campus-wide protests cross the deep fault lines between the Muslim and secular politics and thereby create new alliances between these previously polarized groups. This is what I call contestation within inclusion. Contestation within inclusion is the aspect of Turkish politics that is most relevant to current European encounters with Muslim immigrants. I'm not a big fan of models because they often tend to represent social and political world as ahistorical and static entities. As I highlighted in the beginning of my talk, Turkish case is very distinct in its historically specific linkages between the pious Muslims and the secular state. Against the wish of the Kemalists to own the secular republic, to monopolize it, the pious Muslims of Turkey have developed very strong allegiance with the state of their nation. Religion and politics cannot be studied without taking this historically evolved ties between the pious and their state, no matter how upsetting this has proved to be for the secularists of Turkey. So the burning question regarding Turkey as the model of a secular democracy is really about this, the freedom violations currently. Here's the puzzle. While the JDP integrated entirely into the secular system, in the secular political milieu, secularism has provided no guarantee for liberties and rights. Well, I'm not the only one who's not surprised about it, because many of us in academia don't give credit to secularism the way Enlightenment thinkers did. Secularism needs to be located in a liberal democracy in order to provide those protections. So in my most recent article in Journal on Democracy, I argued that liberties and rights are no longer safe in Turkey, and this could be a temporary situation if we take care of that soon enough. So the burning problem is being ignored, because, you know, we've been way too busy celebrating how secular Turkish Muslims became. I think we really need to take a break from that festivity and focus on the major problem: how freedoms and rights will be institutionally secured throughout this major political transition, which forced the old Islamic elite and the old secularist elite and the new Islamic elite to share powers and resources. Well, this is a challenging issue because both the over-empowered JDP government and its weak secularist opposition by CHP, CHP party, are equally uninterested, I repeat, equally uninterested in expanding and securing individual freedoms and rights. They're also equally incapable of discussing, disagreeing, and contesting this in the parliament. So this is why ordinary people take up the fight to the streets. This is why we see so much split and fault lines on the streets in neighborhoods. And this is why we must take the highly contested urban sites very seriously as part of struggles towards democratization. To conclude, current freedom violations in Turkey are not a trivial issue to be ignored by the international community and by the liberal democrats of Turkey. It needs immediate attention and democratic intervention. At the same time, however, this alarming situation must be analyzed and understood in the larger political context of the politics of engagement and politics of contestation within inclusion. Ironically, if we get this larger picture right, this may locate Turkey ahead of many Western, particularly European countries, which are still trying to cope with the challenge of Muslim accommodation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Bernataram. Professor Karu, would you mind standing? I've been told that it's a bit difficult for the people in back to see. Is that all right?
That's
sorry to spring that on you. Thanks.
I would like to thank to Jonathan and other organizers for this very inspiring conference. So we live in a very dynamic and rapidly changing world. I was in San Diego airport 8 hours ago, and now I am in Boston. So in this dynamic world, Turkey has an important role in bridging Europe and Middle East, which, if I use the cliche. So how many of you have the handouts of my presentation? Could you please raise your hand? Okay, so those who do not have it can share with their friends next to them. So the title of the presentation is a question. Islam, secularism, and democracy, is there a Turkish exceptionalism? My answer will be no and yes, rather than yes and no. I start with the no part. It depends on the framing of the question of exceptionalism. We have two scholars who already framed the question in a particular way. One is Bernard Lewis. According to Lewis, I quote, "Some observers, especially among those who see in Islam an obstacle to democratic development, point to secularism as the crucial difference between Turkey and the rest of the Muslim world." So according to Bernard Lewis, there is a Turkish exceptionalism. Turkey is the only secular state and therefore democracy in the Muslim world. Huntington follows Lewis in many issues, including clash of civilizations and the Turkish exceptionalism. I'm quoting Huntington, "The one Islamic country that sustained even intermittent democracy after World War II was Turkey, which had, under Mustafa Kemal, explicitly rejected its Islamic tradition and defined itself as a secular republic." So, this idea of Turkish exceptionalism based on secular state and democracy has not been an academic jargon, but it is very much a part of daily life, and we can see its reflection in the court decisions. The Turkish Constitutional Court, in several decisions, emphasizes that secularism, in a very strict sense, needed to be in Turkey to protect democracy. And the European Court of Human Rights, when it held the Turkey's Hatzigarp Bennett universities, also emphasized the same point, saying that, in the quotation mark, the notion of a particular notion of secularism, it's what I call assertive secularism, which bans the headscarf at universities, and then I quote again, "may be considered necessary to protect the democratic system in Turkey." And then the court also refers to Islamist threat in the Turkish case. So, based on this framing of exceptionalism, I have two major criticisms. One critique is that if we look at secularism in Turkey, it is not based on the idea of state neutrality, but it is something different. It's based on a social engineering project since the time of the foundation of Republic, and the project is to marginalize religion in the public sphere. So I categorize secularism in two types. One type is the French type, assertive secularism, that require the state to exclude religion from public domain and confine it to a private matter. So that's the Turkish Constitutional Court understanding. That's the generally we call the Kemalist understanding of secularism in Turkey. And it's a general principle you can follow in Mexico, sometimes in the history of Spain and Portugal, and currently in a revised form in France and a declining form in Turkey. But there is another type of secularism that I call passive secularism, which requires the state to play a passive role by tolerating religion in the public sphere, and it's the American type, but also it is dominant ideology in countries like India, Netherlands, and some other liberal countries. So, my critique of Louis Huntington and European Court of Human Rights is that assertive secularism is one type that excludes Islam and all other religions from the public sphere, and Turkey did not become a democracy because of this assertive secularism, but it has become a democracy despite assertive secularism, because there's a big gap between people's demand and the assertive state policies in Turkey. For example, 75% of people wanted the Hatzis-Carpenet universities be lifted, but an organized minority of 25 imposed it by the support of military judiciary in a very authoritarian manner. So I have a list of military intervention. If you look at the list in Turkish politics, you see that there is always back and forth. And my students, when I teach undergrad middle course, like very much Turkish case. It's so predictable that the military step in and intervene in 10 to 15 years. And secularism, assertive secularism, has been a major justification of military interventions in different ways. And recently, a direct military coup was no longer possible. Therefore, this assertive secularism produced different terms, e-coup by internet coup, then judicial coup, and different forms. So that's my first critique of Lewis and Huntington thesis, that assertive secularism is not very democratizing, but it is generally a justification of military intervention. The second caveat in the thesis is empirical, because I have a table of 49 Muslim-majority countries. I look at the countries' populations and categorize those having 50% or more Muslim population as Muslim-majority. Out of these 49 countries, 11 are democracies, so Turkey is not the only democracy. And you see in the table, out of 49, only 11 are Sharia states, like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Brunei, Iran, Mauritania, Oman, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia. And 23 are secular states, starting with Azerbaijan, Burkina Faso, Chad, Eritrea, Gambia, Guinea, Guinea-Bissau, Kazakhstan, Kosovo, Kyrgyzstan, Lebanon, Nigeria, Syria, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and these are authoritarian secular states. And then we have some democratic secular states in the Muslim world, Albania, Indonesia, Mali, Niger, Senegal, Sierra Leone, and Turkey. And the rest of the countries like Egypt, Tunisia, Algeria are in between. They are neither Islamic Sharia state nor a secular state, but in between a mixed form. So therefore, empirically, it's not true that Turkey is the secular state. Yeah, no, there are 22 other secular states with different formations and legal systems, but at least 13 of these 23 explicitly use the term secular in the constitution, saying either this is a secular republic or this is a secular state. Other 10 are like United States. They don't have the term secular in the constitution, but they don't establish Islam as the official religion. Okay, so that's the discussion of the first framing of the idea of exceptionalism. Now, that's the no part, that I don't accept a Turkish exceptionalism of being the only secular state or the only democracy in the Muslim world. But if we narrow the question down, and if we only focus on the Middle East, yes, Turkey appeared to be the only Muslim-majority democracy in the Middle East. Recently, Tunisia, fortunately, became the second one in the Middle East after the Arab Spring. Now Tunisia is categorized, and my data source for this is Freedom House. So according to Freedom House, Turkey was the only democracy, Muslim-majority society in the Middle East. Now Tunisia became the second. And I also have the scores. If you look at the table, you see that Turkey has a score of 3, Tunisia 3.5, 0 country has even 4, then came 4.5, 5, 5.5, 6, and others. So then question why? Why Turkey was the only Muslim-majority democracy in the Middle East? Why this Turkish exceptionalism in the Middle East? So there are 3 major arguments to explain this puzzle. The first one is the relationship between Western institutions and Turkey, and I think this is a very convincing one. Why? Because Turkey has been a member of NATO for about 60 years. It was the only Muslim majority member of NATO until Albania recently became the second Muslim majority NATO member. Now, Turkey has been a member of European Court of Human Rights, European Parliament, and now is a candidate for full EU membership. And always strong connection with European intellectuals, universities, and other institutions. And that's a big plus for Turkish democracy, and it's really made a difference between Turkey and other Middle Eastern countries. The second issue is more domestic. I recently collected data about the budgets of governments, tried to find out the percentages of taxation and natural resources in government revenues. Because there is a model that we call in political science the rentier state model. And if we have three laws in political science, one is no bourgeois, no democracy. If there is no bourgeoisie, there is no democracy. The second, democracies generally don't wage war in each other. And the third one is if there is oil, no democracy. Oil hinders democracy. So I'll just focus on the third one to explain the difference between Turkey and other Middle Eastern countries. So if you look at the table, you see that in Libya, 90% of government revenue comes from oil and natural gas. And then only 5% is coming from taxation. And then if you go down, Iraq 88%, Saudi Arabia 85%, Kuwait 82%, Bahrain, Oman, Yemen, United Arab Emirates, until Syria, Egypt, it is for about 11 Middle Eastern countries, the oil revenue constituted more than half of state revenue, in the total government revenue. For Egypt, Syria, and Tunisia, for Egypt and Syria, it's about a third of the government revenue, and then came the lower rates, and for Turkey it is zero. And taxation in Turkey constitutes 90% of government revenue. So what does that tell us? According to the theory, if oil and natural gas constitute 40% or more of the government's revenue, then the government is not based on taxation, which makes the government independent of society, stronger than social forces, and makes social forces part of state structure. And the motto of the ruler of a rentier state is the opposite of the motto of American Revolution. What does it mean? So the motto, one of the, at least mottos of American Revolution was no taxation without representation. That was what American people taught to the King of Britain. But the King of Saudi Arabia is telling to his own people, no representation without taxation. You guys don't pay tax to me. I allocate you oil money. Therefore, I will never give you representation. So if the government revenue is based on taxation, then the people can use taxation as a way of making rulers accountable. But if the relationship between government and society is not based on extraction of money from the people, if instead it's based on the government's allocation money to the people by currency, by subsidization, by welfare policies, by jobs, then the state is the boss of people. You cannot criticize your boss because he or she will fire you. So in most of the Middle Eastern countries, the rentier state model really shapes state-society relations, and society is very weak. There is no independent media, independent bourgeoisie. It's also a valid argument for Central Asian republics. When I was in Turkmenistan, almost each and every newspaper is written that it is owned by the president. So the president of the country is the owner of the newspapers. You cannot imagine a democracy in such a country. So it is a huge debate. I'll try to answer if you have any question during the question and answer section. But there is a major reason for Turkish exceptionalism in the Middle East: 90% taxation, zero oil reserve. And other, if you look at the list, other countries who have the chance to be democratized are Lebanon, Morocco, Jordan, and Tunisia. Tunisia already achieved. Lebanon is on the way, and I'm waiting some major transformation in Morocco and Jordan. So the King of Jordan will not happy with it, but he doesn't have oil money. So if you look at the next table, You see that in terms of democracy scores, the rentier state, except Syria at the very bottom, are at the bottom of the list. Syria is an exception, and we are hopeful to see a change there. But rather than Syria, all rentier states are at the top of the list. So I said the three explanation. One, the relation with the West. The other, the oil shaping state-society relations. And the third approach is Islam. So there are scholars who argue that Turkey has a unique understanding of Islam, and sometimes they call it Turkish Islam. I have never understood what they try to mean, and I don't even think they know what they mean by that. So it's not insulting, but just a joke. So why? Because if Turkey has a specific Islam, do you mean theologically Turks believe a different Islam, or practically, or is it Sufism, or that's still on the tables. We are looking someone to explain it. But if we look at the political aspect of the issue, Islamic political theory, based on this argument, the Ottoman Empire had a major legacy, inheritance, a rich debate about parliamentary regime, because the Ottomans had the parliament in 1876, and the Muslims produced Islamic ideas to justify the parliamentary regime at that time. But then came the Republic, certain level of exclusion of Islamic ideas, certain level of amnesia. Then in 1970s, when Islamism became again a public issue, there no longer was the Ottoman heritage. Therefore, the Islamists in Turkey translated the Islamist work from Egypt and Pakistan. It was something unfortunate that Turks, Islamists in Turkey, rather than reading their own original texts written by Ottoman ancestors, they read Pakistani and Egyptians. And when you look at today Turkey, there is almost zero intellectual development in terms of producing an Islamic political theory about liberalism, about democracy, about human rights. And that's a major challenge in Turkey for AK Party, for Gulen Movement, for any Islamic group in Turkey. Because what we see is that Turkey is going toward a post-Kemalist era. And in the post-Kemalist Turkey, we don't have a consistent and well-developed Islamic theory of liberal and democratic values. And if in the future Turkey is able to produce something about it, it may be inspirational for the rest of the Middle East. So to sum up, if we look at the idea of Turkish exceptionalism, in terms of broader Muslim world, Turkey is not exceptional. There are many other democratic and secular states like Senegal in Africa, Indonesia in South Asia. But if we look at into the Middle East, yes, there is a certain level of Turkish exceptionalism because of Turkey's relations with Western institutions. It doesn't have any oil resource. And in the future, maybe it can produce some liberal Islamic theory that can be engaged with the debate throughout the region. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Professor Kuru. Those were two really brilliant presentations. I think the first being a somewhat sober and cautionary message, and the second being somewhat more cautiously optimistic. And I guess it felt a little bit like watching a tennis match where, I mean, personally, I wanted to go on and I wanted to end in a draw. The question I have, I guess, in response to what Professor Kuru provocatively asked, you know, what is Turkish Islam? Well, the Turkish Republic has provided an answer for that since 1924 or so in the form of a presidency for religious affairs located in the prime minister's office. And this is one of the large and perhaps bloated bureaucracies of the state with as many as 100,000 employees. And so my question for both of you, just to start us off, is what is the fate of the Diyanet, this presidency for religious affairs, in the new republic? I know that one think tank close to the government has suggested that if it were to come to a time of constitutional reform, that the Diyanet would be looked at very closely and that perhaps it would be targeted by this liberalizing trend of allowing for perhaps more freedoms for religious affairs, but therefore also less state involvement, less state guarantee of the very dividing line between religion and politics that you both spoke of. And this is, I think, the one way in which this has nothing to do with French assertive secularism, because French assertive secularism stopped having a constitutional clergy in the mid-19th century, whereas Turkey has continued to have the equivalent of a constitutional clergy. So I'd just like to have perhaps both of your views on that and then open up the discussion.
Okay, so you're asking about future prescriptive analysis. What happens to Diyanet in the future?
Given what you saw in Kazakhstan, for example,
yeah,
and the cooperation.
Well, okay, I mean, usually I really try not to do prescriptive analysis because as Huntington did some predictions, and we've been talking about them for 20 years, and I think it you can always refute it because it's hard for us without putting people into the labs. It's hard for us to see the future, but let me give you my perspective on it without making prescriptive, without saying anything prescriptive about the future. When we look at the constitutional amendments today, I mean the ones that are already done, there has been a crisis over constitutional reform, and the advocates and the opponents of constitutional reform have debated everything except for the issue, the burning issue of freedoms and rights in Turkey. What I'm trying to say is, both the government and its opposition, so both the advocates of constitutional reform and the opponents of it, are more interested in undermining each other and attacking each other whenever it's possible by taking their liberties away, by jailing people from the other side. The discussions have not included anything specifically about expanding anybody's freedoms. There has been some discussion and some changes in the constitution about affirmative action for the disabled and children, etc. That's the only exception. The rest of the constitution amendments aimed at changing the balance of power relations within the constitutional court, within the military, here and there. It's a power struggle. Nobody cares about freedoms. So in that sense, if you're asking me if the constitutional reform next time is promising to make any change in terms of freedom of religion, what we have seen so far, the constitutional reform has almost nothing to do with expansion of freedoms and rights. This is sad because this is the product of 1980 military coup, and the constitution, as Ahmed's recent book clearly suggests, the constitution of Turkey is the weakest when it comes to individual freedoms and civil rights. It's, instead of protecting the citizens, and citizens' freedoms, it's protecting the state from its citizens. Nothing has changed so far. I mean, all this fight between the advocates and opponents are about other things. Who's going to have more power? Who's going to control the court? Who's going to control the military? In that sense, I'm actually very pessimistic unless some attention is paid to this and some international interference, maybe from international community, which was attempted at some point. A collaboration between Columbia University and some constitutional experts was attempted, and then it was criticized as foreign intervention. Ahmed can tell you more about that. So I'm not very optimistic about this kind of change in the near future in Turkey.
Thank you.
Yes, I would like to thank to Berna for reminding when I suggested passive secularist transformation in Turkey. The newspaper Milliyet published my picture, and beneath it they wrote passive secularism from Ahmet Kur made in USA. For them, it is an American conspiracy that somehow we are organizing things here and transferring to Turkey.
What so, do you think today is all about?
Yes, exactly. This is another conspiracy. Excellent question from you about Diyanet, thank you. And I would like to touch briefly, starting with France. Until 1905, you are right that they had the Diyanet-type relations between the Catholic Church and the French state. At that time, assertive secularists had two projects. One project defended by Prime Minister Emil Comb was to make the Catholic Church obedient to the state, because for him an independent church would be too dangerous. It should be kept under state authority. But the others, like Alistair Briand, they defended more liberal separation. Eventually, Emil Combes' idea was defeated. Even he himself changed his mind. Then France embraced the separation model. But Turkey, I think, after 20 years later, embraced Emil Combes' original idea of keeping Islam under state control by Diyanet. At this point, there is a debate about Diyanet. And recently, there was an Abant meeting who proposed and making independent a kind of semi-independent institution. And when I interviewed the former president and the current president of Diyanet, they seem to be also prone to accept two transformations. One is to make the budget of Diyanet independent of state budget, and Diyanet will be funded by simply foundations, because at the time of the foundation of the Republic, the Turkish state confiscated the Islamic pious foundations. Now, if they let the Diyanet be funded by them, no need to get money from the state budget. The second thing is appointment. The president now is appointed by the prime minister. And if they have a board of trustees, it can become a semi-independent institution, and it's a solution. Then Diyanet can really become a source of inspiration, because right now, in many Middle Eastern countries, the Islamic institutions are controlled by state and used as a justification of authoritarianism. And the famous or infamous example is El-Azhar. Since 1960s, the Sheikh of El-Azhar is a political nominee. The Egyptian president appoints the Sheikh of El-Azhar. It's very much Diyanet model. So it's already in Middle East, but it's not a good model. Why? Because it makes religion part of authoritarian power structure.
Thank you. Well, no, that is a very significant and far-reaching implications for the way Islam is organized, both in Turkey and within the Turkish diaspora, as I think we'll discuss in the next panel. But first, I'd like to open the discussion up to you, the participants in this conference. Please identify yourself and have your question end with a question mark. Thank you. Please. It's a question about urban contestation.
Do I answer now?
Okay. If you'd like.
I'm talking on the basis of an ethnography, and I study urban sites of contestation. By that, I mean highly divided urban sites over issues relating to Muslim politics. Let me give you an example. University campuses have been deeply divided over the issue of headscarf. So it creates fault lines, people take sites, and they look as these sites, and I handpick them. It's an ethnography, multi-sided ethnography. That means I don't pre-plan the sites, I follow the sites as these divides happen. So these sites from outside look as torn sites, deeply divided, very polarized. We hear so much about them, and they're very vocal places. We hear about these. So these are famous places, if you allow me to say. We hear about them a lot in media because there are very famous, I don't know, scholars, journalists, university students who are getting arrested. So there is voice coming out of it, and it all sounds negative because, I mean, what is good about all these fault lines? So I've been looking in these sites for the last 5 years, and I'm arguing that beyond that facade, not facade, they're really arguing, contesting, fighting. Feelings get hurt. It gets sometimes very personal. But beyond all of that, these sites are the specific sites which unite and unify against freedom violations, most vocally. So I'm not generalizing these sites to the entire country. I'm admitting that I handpick these sites and I follow these sites from Turkey to abroad. For example, if I study a highly divided neighborhood in Turkey, I actually follow this neighborhood study to the Turkish neighborhood in Germany, Kreuzberg, and look at the neighborhood politics there. So that this is how it makes it multi-sided. And out of these divided sites, I analyze the patterns of contestation. And one last thing, this kind of contestation, I don't see as polarization because it's really happening after the inclusion of the pious Muslims into the sites. In other words, they're actually already progressive because they have already opened up and included them. That's why they're fighting so much anyway. I don't know if this answers. Yeah. Omer Tashpinar.
Okay. Thank you for great presentations.
You could stand and speak up. Thank you.
Thank you for two great presentations. I have one question for Dana and one topic. Dana, I was really intrigued by your comment in a positive way about the Kemalist approach or the secularist approach and the pious conservative Islamist approach to gender creating the same result, that they both want women to participate or to be part of the public sphere without really allowing them room for in decision making, I think you said, right? Mm-hmm. So real empowerment. What would change in Turkey, in your opinion, this gender dilemma? What would create women's empowerment? Do you see any movement beyond the secular Kemalist sphere or the Islamic sphere that would actually trigger something more substantial in terms of gender issues, gender empowerment? And do you see also a similar dynamic in the Kemalist, secularist and Islamic approach to the Kurdish question, is creating the same kind of dilemmas that the Kurdish question, the most important, urgent question of Turkey. Is there also similarities in the way Kemalists and pious conservatives, Islamists, since we use these terms in a way interchangeably, approach the Kurdish question? And what would create a different approach to the Kurdish question if we don't see any difference in the way Islamists or Kemalists approach the Kurdish issue? And now, back to you, question about the transition from assertive to passive secularism. When you look at your case studies, what are the elements that create the transition from assertive, radical, militant secularism to more tolerant, more passive secularism? Because there is this transition usually from authoritarian systems to democratization. There is a huge literature on democratization, and it seems to me what makes Turkey really different is that it is a democracy, but still a very illiberal democracy. So aren't we in a way debating the transition from being a illiberal democracy to being a liberal democracy? And what would create, in your opinion, in Turkey, liberal democracy with this kind of passive secularism? Are we there yet? You mentioned that Turkey is no longer this militant secularism, but what are the elements that would liberalize in a way Turkish democracy?
Thank you. Were people able to hear in back the questions? Yeah, okay. Professor Kuru, would you please take your question first?
Sure. Thanks for the question. Very important and challenging one. So there are other examples besides Turkey that we see the transformation of assertive secularism or move from assertive to passive. One is Mexico. In 1992, the Catholic Church didn't have legal existence in Mexico. It was a formally illegal church. Then, as part of the late third wave or the following the democratization worldwide after the collapse of Soviet Union, Mexico embraced new amendments and laws and move a bit from assertive to passive. And you are right; it's definitely a part of democratization because it directly coincides with democracy in Mexico. In France, its assertive secularism had much more popular support than it has in Turkey. Therefore, it emerged with multi-party regime. But democratization, especially after the Second World War, resulted in moderation of assertive secularism in France. And when it comes to Catholicism today, it is hard to talk about an assertive French state because right now, a fourth of students are going to Catholic schools and all teachers' salaries paid by French state in Catholic schools. There are so many gestures and accommodation. But when it comes to Islam, the French state shows its assertive face again. In the Turkey directly, it's an issue of democratization. You are absolutely right. Why? Because each time the right wing parties, from Menderes to Demirel, from Demirel to Özal, and Özal from Erdogan now, try to moderate, try to eliminate some restrictions, but military intervention, judicial interventions, kept some policies, headscarf ban and discrimination of graduates of Imam Hatip schools, or the ban on Quran for students under 15 or 12 years old to learn how to read the Quran. So these are assertive policies against Muslims, but also assertive policies against Christians and Jews in Turkey. The Halkalı Seminary is still closed. And until last year, the property rights of Christian and Jewish foundations were not recognized. At least there were limitations. But what we see in Turkey, the move from assertive to passive secularism, is in parallel with democratization. The tutelage, the military tutelage, you call it illiberal democracy, is weakened. Now, 60 out of 360 generals of Turkey are in prison. So the military generals are now touchable. They are no longer untouchable. Then judicial system also changed after 2010 referendum. So now assertive secularists are no longer powerful in Turkey. Therefore, we are seeing some reforms. In terms of Christian and Jews, now the laws change about building temple. There are much more freedom now for them. Then their confiscated properties were given back. There are still things to do, like Halkalı Seminary, but big steps forward, reforms are already made. When it comes to freedoms of Muslims, these three issues, headscarf ban, and then Imam Hatip's and the Quran courses, are still on the way. But I think Berna is right that it is a balance of power thing. But what I see that in the daily life, the problem is minimal. In Turkey, the problem of secularism, what at the state level. Therefore, whenever we see democratization, so normally people are tolerant of religious, non-religious things, drinking alcohol or wearing bikini. Within the same family, you see pious people or very secular people together. But the main problem was between politicians and state apparatus. And then democratization will hopefully, in 10 years or so, will solve the problem. But it will not automatically make Turkey a liberal democracy. It's the goal ends. It's much more deeper thing to reach. But at least in terms of religious freedom, it will be a more free country. But other freedoms, Berna emphasized, freedom of speech, associations, these are related but independent issues.
Berna Trump.
Thank you. So, women's issues, gender politics. Is this on? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, that's a very good question. So in my study, this is my first book, I was talking about gender politics in the Gulen movement, arguing that they only adopt the gender politics from the secularist male elite. So I was really looking at the male elite. I mean, it's kind of like masculinity studies almost. I didn't really study the women, or at least that argument doesn't come from the study of the woman. Later on, I looked at the woman more carefully in the movement and JDP. So here's the issue. As Yeşim Arat clearly argued many, many decades ago, yes, Atatürk handpicked women and inserted them into the parliament, and these women were not empowered, they weren't given the power to make decisions, but Turkish women, the secular Turkish women, later on took the advantage of those positions in the parliament and in the public sphere and created their own movement. So Turkey has a strong feminist secular movement. It actually happened. What is not happening so far is a strong Islamic feminist movement. And it actually almost appeared, again, Yeşim Arat studied it during the time of the Welfare Party in 1990s, when the Welfare gave some space, breathing space to women where they could develop their own feminist movement, and then JDP undermined it entirely. So what we see right now is that we have this Gulen movement and the JDP, which kind of resemble each other in terms of the absence of a strong Islamic feminist movement. But this is not surprising at all, because they both are conservative religious parties. They're not radical, they're not militant, they're not revolutionary. And we know in feminist literature that only revolutionary radical movements incorporate women because they need the woman to overthrow the regime or to make a real change. So in this setting in Turkey, when we look at the pious, they're happy with the status quo. They're very happy to keep women in their place in their traditional roles. Well, so the move that the secularist woman did in Turkey is not really coming out. And I call this politics of non-resistance. You cannot force women to organize. I mean, so far, I don't see any much interest, especially in the Gulen movement, to organize a women's movement. JDP is a little bit ahead of time because the same people who organize in Welfare Party for women's rights are still alive, but just a little bit silenced. What I'm trying to say, Ömer, is that by looking at the male elite, we cannot really expect a change in terms of women's equality. Women have to do it for themselves. And the picture right now in Turkey is that the secularist woman and the pious Muslim woman have very little platform to cooperate for a very efficient women's organization and movement. This is unfortunate. They have different ways of doing politics. Non-resistance versus aggressive Kemalist feminists. They don't see the world similarly. One likes submission because of submission to God. The other one is aggressive and increasingly bitter because they're thinking everything they did in their life in terms of feminism is melting into the air. And that creates a gap. So the less differences there are between the secularist and pious women in Turkey in terms of education, money, lifestyle, the more similar they are, the less cooperative they became. And that's not the good ground to organize a strong feminist movement. So we need work there. I've been part of some feminist groups that really try to bring all women from all these identity groups together, including Armenians, Kurds. It's not working. I mean, I can tell you more later. It's just simply not working because of very divisive identity politics. Now, I'm jumping to the Kurdish issue, the same problem. The pious Muslims and the secularists, they're actually so similar they're not realizing it, but they have different ways of doing politics sometimes. The only missing thing is, in order to push freedoms in Turkey, whether it's freedom of religion, like in your question it was Diyanet, or whether it's freedom of women or Kurds, we have a pending freedom issue because the liberals of this country, the actual political liberals, not neoliberals, politically liberal people who care about individual freedom, freedom of expression, they cannot find any party to vote in Turkey, yet they're too busy and too indifferent to lobby, mobilize, or form their own party. So the liberal voice gets lost. It's not hurt. They only complain and bitch about things, but they don't do anything, actually. So we are left with this out-of-date rift between the old Kemalists and the new Islamists. They're not interested in freedoms. That's their least concern. I mean, 301 has been sitting there forever. No one cares. So in terms of the Kurdish problem, we really need liberal Democrats to be involved in politics. That's why I'm starting to look at the international community now, because the voice is not really producing itself within Turkey. Thank you.
Thank you. We have time for one more question. Well, actually, more than that. I'm going to start with Professor Ali Banwazizi, and then I'm going to actually gather the last three and ask you to just be brief as possible. Thank you.
Many thanks for the wonderful presentation. One question. You talked about the political and social dynamics of democratization and the many ways in which Turkey is exceptional. I wonder if you comment on economic dimension of this and the many ways in which the relatively liberal and free market economy that's tried in Turkey in the 1980s and 90s contributed to this democratization and provided the foundation for it. Obviously, in your analysis of the Armenian state, you implicitly, I think, refer to it.
Next, I have a question from the young woman here. Yes?
Thank you for a wonderful lecture. My name is Taiful Kartma, I listen to I'm Danish citizen. Denmark is, as you can hear from Denmark, is not a secular state. There is established religion and no separation between church and state. But it is a deeply democratically run country. And I'm thinking maybe we should notice much more about the culture of democracy that has been in this country for centuries. So it is, it's not a, it's just a formal separation, but what is actually is being, I think that you mentioned about being really emphasized on the individual freedom. Mm-hmm. And,
thank you. The gentleman in the second row.
Turgay Erdem. Let me ask my question first. What do you think about the future of Imam Hatip high schools? These people, in last time also, the cause Fisbah in Parliament, this is 14 to 17 years at age. 14 years person is 8th grade, so high school 2nd grade. Now, these people don't know English, don't know the world, don't study other religions. How could they be a mature contributor to the society in terms of having a tie or a peace between seculars and religious people? These schools were proliferated in 1982. So, in my opinion, a good progress in Turkey when Turkey takes religious education to higher education so that people become open-minded, become able to question things so that they could contribute to the society better than a high school student.
Okay, I think we get the gist of it. Thank you very much. And there was one last question. I would just ask you to be brief. Thank you. Yes, you, sir. Thank you. These are four superb questions that I know deserve so much more time than we're able to give them. I'm just going to ask you to be as brief as possible, maybe answer in just about 3 minutes each, just to stay on schedule. Thanks.
Oh, okay. I think Ahmed has more questions, so I will just engage with the culture of democracy, Danish question, and the education. Culture of democracy, political culture. Well, I actually did some field work in Denmark on the Gulen schools 10 years ago. Yes, it is a democracy and it's liberal, but when we discuss Muslims in Europe, do the same freedoms and rights apply to the Muslims? I mean, there's a serious Islamophobia, and when I was conducting research in Denmark, this is before the crisis of Muhammad's pictures, caricatures, basically, every Muslim, and the largest Muslim majority is Turkish, told me that the Danish state's official ideology is to make good Danes out of Turks. So what I'm trying to say is liberal democracies are sometimes only liberal to their own religious majority. Muslims in Europe are actually complaining in almost all countries, but specifically in France, Germany, Denmark, in Holland, about discrimination and non-recognition for their rights and freedoms. And these countries have proven almost equally unsuccessful in accommodating Muslim minorities. So When I apply this to the culture of democracy, political culture in Turkey, the same issue. This is identity politics, which is very divisive. When we discuss freedoms in Turkey, it's always in the form of this. Freedom for the headscarfed women. Freedom for the women who don't cover their heads. Freedom for the Kurds. Freedom for Armenians. No, because liberal democracy and the real democrat cares for liberties of everybody, not just one group or not just for himself. And that's the weak aspect in both European countries and Turkey currently. I think we share a lot of problems, by the way, in terms of Muslim accommodation. Reform is needed. And the second question about place of education in democracy. Yes, liberal thinking in Turkish education is a crying game. It's a burning problem. But I can't see the cool aspect. But there is this issue. Even in academia, not just high schools, in Western countries, there is this new trend that Enlightenment thinking liberalism is just not being taught well anymore. I don't know, there are other trendy, fashionable approaches, post-colonialism, identity politics, deconstructivism. And there is this point where almost liberal stands for neoliberal, and it has a bad connotation. We are so lazy to differentiate politically liberal from neoliberal and like defend it by using Enlightenment thinkers' ideas about individual freedom. So in terms of education, yes, Turkish education system needs a lot of reform, but I see similar trends in the United States. Freedoms have been not on the agenda for so long, and the security states, United States, Israel, and Turkey mainly, are just creating these measures against alleged terrorist activities, and this actually requires more attention on freedoms now, especially now. I don't know if this answers your question.
Thank you, Bernard Trump.
Yes, so now, three questions, Group. Thanks for each of them, starting with free market. Yes, you are right, it's an important dimension of democratization in Turkey, but it's related to the two factors I mentioned. One is ties with Western institutions. Turkey has already been part of European Customs Union for about 10 years or so. And the second thing is the taxation-based economy rather than oil-based economy, which is another incentive for Turkish rule politicians to move from import substitute economy to export oriented economy. The second issue about Imam Hatip's and other schools, yes, Turkey has an education problem. The school system needs to be reformed. And it doesn't matter whether it's a religious based school or more secular school, the quality is important, the content of important. And you can teach religion with more emphasis on questioning. Or you can teach secularism in a very dogmatic way. So the content and style is important. So every day students are reciting a pledge today in Turkey, and the pledge is extremely nationalistic. It may be maybe updated and revised, if not abolished. So, and even in non-religious secular schools, they don't teach English well. They only know, my name is Ahmed. So it's a joke. So the last one is that the formal constitutional design is important. Yes, Denmark is an established church state, but it's a democracy. It shows that secularism is not necessary or sufficient condition. But the culture, yes, democracy is a culture, but there are always some borders and limitations. Think of Switzerland. I thought Switzerland was a very democratic country with democratic culture, but they banned minarets despite the fact that there were only four minarets in Switzerland. They banned it by referendum. It wasn't a parliamentary decision. So we show the borders of European democratic culture there. And if we compare United States and Britain, we see the importance of formality, because we have a First Amendment here based on which the Supreme Court struck down the Bible reading and prayer. But in Britain, they don't have this. They have established, therefore they can recite prayer, Lord's Prayer and Bible reading in British schools. Therefore, laws matter.
Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking the panel.